From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Each week, several dozen people in Maryland die from opioid use. Last summer, Nikki Nierman, a nursing staff coordinator, lost her fiancé to a heroin overdose. She tells us of his episodes of treatment and how his addiction disrupted their lives.
We wanted to believe him. I always wanted to believe him. Like, I didn't want to be a parole officer. I really wanted to be his partner. And that was a fine line to ride.
And Donna Jacobs, a senior vice president at the University of Maryland Medical System, tells us about next week's conference on substance abuse and recovery called Not All Wounds Are Visible. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. More than 1,000 people have died in Maryland from opioid overdoses in the first 6 months of this year. Opioid overdoses have been on the rise since 2010, and deaths caused by the drug fentanyl, a very powerful opioid, now surpass those caused by heroin. To address the opioid epidemic, the University of Maryland Medical System will hold a community conference next week. The event, called Not All Wounds Are Visible, is focused on addiction and substance abuse. It will give healthcare professionals who've been affected by drug addiction an opportunity to share their stories. Nikki Nierman is a nursing staff coordinator at the University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center. Last summer, her fiancé, Trey, died from a heroin overdose. Nikki, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about Trey.
Trey was a pure soul. He was like a gentle giant. That's the best way to put it, really. He was 6'4", so he was very tall. Tall and skinny, you know. And he was just so gentle and kind and sweet to everybody that he met. And I didn't really realize this till after he had passed away. Of course, I knew I loved him, but I didn't realize how much his friends, his family. I didn't really realize how much everybody loved him, even friends that he hadn't seen in 5-10 years. He would give anybody the shirt off his back, like he would have. It's hard to speak of him in the past tense still.
Still?
Yeah, it's very hard still.
How long had he struggled with heroin?
With heroin since he was about 18 or 19.
How did it start? How did it grow?
Trey and I grew up in the same group of people, I guess you could say. Baltimore is a small place, you know what I mean? So I lived in Reisterstown, he lived in Owings Mills. We knew a lot of the same people. I knew him, but we weren't dating at that time. And everybody was using opioids. Everyone was trying Oxycontins at this time, you know, or Percocets or Vicodin. I don't want to say everyone, but it was very popular. It was a popular thing to do at parties. But it's not a drug. Not everyone can just pick it up and put it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why it's so deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when he had become addicted to opioids, someone that he had met through that introduced him to heroin because it's cheaper, easier to get, and it gives you a bigger high, you know, because that's what you're always chasing.
And were you close to Trey when that part was happening?
No, I was not. Trey started using pretty young, between 18 and 19. And once you start using a drug that intense, things fall apart very quickly. And his parents definitely knew something was going on. And he then went to Right Turn, which is in Reisterstown, which is a treatment center. And then he was off on his way to Florida. He went to a sober living home there.
So he actually left the state.
Yeah, he left the state.
Trying to treat this addiction.
Yes. And there were times he had told me around in, you know, all these 7 years that he was moving around that he had picked up again, you know, and then put it down. Or he didn't stay sober the whole time. He didn't stay in a program the whole time. Once he left South Florida, he wasn't doing NA anymore. He had decided, you know, he was going to try to live a normal life, quote unquote.
And handle it himself.
Yes. When we reconnected, I was living in Florida at that time. I moved down there to go to school. Him and I reconnected. We had always kept in touch. Like I said, like, Trey was a very good friend, and he would reach out to people, like, always, you know, try to, like, instead of writing letters, because the modern day is the internet, you know, he would write letters, but he'd write a letter type of thing in an email. Mm-hmm. You know, he, like, every few months, just all of a sudden, oh, there's Trey, just wanting to see how things are. And that's just the type of person he was. He just always was thinking about the people he cared about.
So when you reconnected, did you think he had a serious drug problem?
When we reconnected, I did not think he did. I mean, obviously, I knew about his past. I definitely knew about his past. He was doing okay when we reconnected. He was, you know, because there were periods of time he wasn't doing okay and periods of time he was. At this point in time, he was. We decided we wanted to be together after seeing each other a couple times, and it went really quickly. Like, it was very fast moving. Because we got together February 2013. We were engaged in April of 2013. And then we were having Hunter. We knew that I was pregnant with Hunter September of 2013. So it all happened very quickly.
So Hunter was born in 2014.
Yes, he was born May 2014.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Nikki Nierman, who lost her fiancé Trey to a heroin overdose last summer. She's a nursing staff coordinator and will be speaking at Not All Wounds Are Visible, a community conference being held by the University of Maryland Medical System next Wednesday. And so did things spin apart in an obvious way? I mean, were you expecting what happened last summer to happen?
That's a tough question to answer. I never expected Trey to die. After Hunter was born, you know, we were the only ones of our family who were living in Florida for the most part, and we came back to visit when Hunter was 3 months. And, you know, it was great to see him around family and just have family there with us during this really special time of having a newborn baby. And we looked at each other. We were actually on the way to a preseason Ravens game, and we were on the light rail, and we said, "This is home." You know, and we started to talk more seriously about it, moving back home. And we did talk about the dangers of moving back to Baltimore, too. And I remember Trey making an important point to me that if he wanted to use, he would find it anywhere. You know, it's not so much Baltimore, because I was worried about that, mm-hmm. moving back to Baltimore and the temptation being too much. But I trusted that he would come to me if something was going on, because I would do the same with him. Mm-hmm. You know, so we moved back December of 2014, right the week before Christmas, and he started using in January of 2015, some point. It was very quickly after that. And there were a lot of signs that something was going on. It was a confusing time when I look back on it. It seems very blurry to me, honestly, because he was working a lot, putting in a lot of overtime. I'm raising a child in a new state, trying to get settled. And we were living with Trey's mom, and we knew something was going on. And when I would confront Trey, he would laugh it off or get very defensive. I guess it really depended on his mood. Then in June of 2015, that's when everything came out that he was using, and he didn't, you know, I confronted him about it, and he was ready to talk about it. It seemed like he agreed to go to treatment the next morning. I was hopeful at that point that things were going to be okay, especially I felt good about the treatment center that he was in. It seemed like he wasn't hating it. No one should like it. He wasn't hating it there. He was there for 28 days.
That was inpatient treatment.
Inpatient, yes. He did outpatient after that for a month at a place called MARC, Maryland Addiction Recovery Center. And they wanted him to stay longer doing outpatient, and Trey really wanted to get back to working. He had two guys that he was going to meetings with a lot. One was his sponsor, and they were both friends from high school that he knew. And then one of them died of an overdose.
And how did that affect Trey?
He was really upset. And after that, Trey became very isolated. And Trey ended up relapsing middle of November 2015. And this time it was different because he overdosed. And I was home and Hunter was home, and I had to, you know, break open the bathroom door to revive him, and paramedics came. the 911 operator talked me through CPR and getting him in a safe position. It was like a scene from a movie, you know, like even when I talk about it and I can picture it, it was just the scariest thing that I think you can walk in on, like one of the scariest things. It was definitely, it was horrific. There's no other way to put it. Like with my child crying in the background, why this is happening, and there's just everything was happening all at once. It was extremely scary. But he did get Narcan. He was taken to a local hospital, and they let him leave after 2 hours. I mean, they didn't even, like, give him a sheet of meeting lists or, you know, any numbers to call. No one came in and said, I was waiting for a social worker to come in and say, hey, do you want to talk about your options? Or, you know, and then he could have said whatever he wanted to. After that relapse, you know, he said, he told us it was his only time doing it. You know, it was his first time doing it since he had been out of treatment, and that he was going to go back to meetings and everything was going to be okay. And because of the hustle and bustle of the holidays, I think that we all kind of, we wanted to believe him. I always wanted to believe him, because what's the point if you don't believe, you know, like I didn't want to be a parole officer. I really wanted to be his partner. And that was a fine line to ride. It's hard to figure out when you're overstepping. Then not even a week later, he almost overdosed again. Luckily, nobody else was involved, but he totaled his car and he went into a halfway house after that. And he did okay in that halfway house he was there almost 7 months. Then around the time that he had been there for about 6 months, we really wanted to be back together as a family. It was starting to strain, you know, on our relationship. So we decided that we were going to start house hunting and we were going to have a fresh start. We found a beautiful house that we loved, and we signed for it June 28th of 2016. We moved in July 15th of 2016, and Trey passed away August 4th, 2016.
Tell me about the day he died.
That morning, he was always out of the house by 7 o'clock, usually exactly, because he had to be at work at 8. And he came over to the bed, he kissed me and told me, I love you, have a nice day. And I happened to look at my phone after he left, and it was 6:30 a.m., which was a little early for him to leave. And usually he would tell me if they had an early job. So it wasn't completely abnormal, but I thought, should I call? You know, for a second, I was going to call him, and I didn't. I fell back asleep. I called him when Hunter woke up at 8 o'clock, and he didn't answer. So then I was meeting a friend for breakfast with her daughters. I called him when we pulled into the parking lot again. He didn't answer again. That was around 10 o'clock. And it was about 11, almost 11:30 is when I got the call from his work. And it was the boss's wife who runs the office. And she said, we just want to make sure Trey is okay. And I said, I immediately had this horrible sick feeling, I guess you could say. So what do you mean? She said, well, he didn't come to work today and we haven't heard from him. You know, I called the police. The police told me to wait at my house, you know, with a picture of him and write down addresses of places that he likes to go to. I was waiting for the police while I called my sister, and I had also called Trey's mother, who was working at the time at St. Joe's. And she said immediately, which I guess she really felt maternal instinct on this, someone needs to go to my house. And that's where Trey was. He was at her house. The feeling is strange. It's like, feels like you're watching a movie, but the movie is your life. And you just, for me, I just couldn't believe that this happened. You know, like the man that I was just with the night before, and we were talking about projects we were going to do on the house, and he was telling me all about the new air conditioning unit he wanted to put outside in the coming summer and how he was going to put it in, and he's gone within a flash. And then, you know, I looked over at my son, and really, it was a lot to handle all at once. And it still is a lot to handle.
How have you been taking care of yourself?
By getting up every day. I mean, that's just, luckily, Hunter, our son, he's an angel, because he is my reason for doing everything now. because so much has changed since that day. We were just getting used to living in this house. That's a big thing. You know, buying a house is a big thing. We're still in the house, but my whole plan had to change, I guess you could say. You know, like, not that I would have everything planned out perfectly, but I just had to change everything completely. It can be a lot to handle, but children are amazingly resilient. And Hunter was young. He was 2 years and 3 months when this happened. My biggest fear is, of course, he won't remember his father. Because, you know, when I think of my earliest memories, there might be flashes from when I was, like, 3 or 4, but not big ones. And I don't want Trey's death to outweigh his life to his son. You know, like, when I do have to tell him how it happened and what happened, I don't want what happened, I don't want his death to be bigger than his life.
So what do you hope Hunter grows up knowing about Trey?
I hope he grows up knowing what a great person he was. And I hope he grows up knowing how much he loved him. And there's always this, a big fear of mine is that a lot of people feel like, why weren't, you know, when it comes to overdoses and stuff, when a loved one overdoses, why, or I felt, at least I should say, why wasn't I enough? Why wasn't Hunter enough? But that's not what it's about at all. And I don't want Hunter to ever feel that way. And I want him to know, like, it's a tragic thing what happened to Trey, but I don't want that to be the only thing people think of when they think of him, especially his own son. So now what I try to do is we talk about, you know, like, when I'm with Trey's mom, we talk about funny stories about Trey. Jan will tell stories to Hunter about when Trey was a child. And Hunter talks about his dad all the time. He knows that his dad's in heaven. Sometimes he even picks up, like, one of his fake phones and he calls him. And he never seems sad about it. He just kind of knows that's the way it is. But I think he's still trying to understand exactly what's going on. So he's really, he's a remarkable little boy.
Nikki, I really admire how you're handling this. Good
Thank
luck.
You.
Nikki Nierman is a nursing staff coordinator. She lost her fiancé, Trey, to a heroin overdose last summer. We need to take a short break on the record. When we're back, we'll learn about the community conversation the University of Maryland Medical System is planning about drug addiction and treatment. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about the opioid overdoses which steal the lives of dozens of Marylanders each week. Nikki Nierman told us about her fiancé Trey's ultimately futile struggle against heroin addiction. Addiction and treatment will be the focus of a community conversation the University of Maryland Medical System is planning for next Wednesday morning. Its title is Not All Wounds Are Visible, and Donna Jacobs, a senior vice president with the medical system, is here to tell us about it. Welcome, Donna.
Thank you very much.
What is the goal of this conference?
The goal this time is about community conversations, giving ordinary, everyday people who live in their communities an opportunity to speak with specialists, providers who can import information that may be useful to them. This is part of a series that we've begun. We did a day-long session on a number of things related to mental health and substance abuse, and we covered quite a number of topics. We contemplated that people would want to ask questions, and we thought we built in enough time for the questions, and by far it was insufficient. Someone sitting next to me said, oh my, this is like water in an oasis, that there are so many people, water in the desert, that there are so many people who have questions to ask and they're hungry and thirsty for this information. So we decided, following that segment, that we would break the topics down one by one. And so the first single standalone topic that we're doing is addiction and substance abuse.
Why was it important to the University of Maryland Medical System to gear this event to the public and not medical professionals?
Well, as you may know, many all hospitals, not-for-profit hospitals, have to provide community benefits to the communities that they serve. And we do that. We take that very, very seriously. For years now, we've known in the medical community that there are insufficient resources available for mental health and behavioral health issues generally. People don't know where to go to get service, and they often come to the emergency room, and once they do, there may not be some place to go following that. The public have many, many, many questions. And so it was important for us to reach out in this area in particular. There are so many chronic diseases that are serviced all the time, and people get care that they need. There are classes that are available to residents in the community and so many locations, but the same is not true in mental health services or in substance abuse and addiction services.
So who are some of the speakers next Wednesday?
So there are five physicians who will be speaking, actually. Two are from the University of Maryland Medical Center. One is Dr. Eric Weintraub, who helped actually design this day with us. And the other one is Dr. Christopher Welsh. Both of them are psychiatrists at the medical center. And then we have Dr. Schwartz, who is from the University of Maryland Capital Region Health, which is newly acquired. That's the Dimensions Hospital down in Prince George's County. He's an emergency room physician, and he sees patients on a daily basis who come in need, having overdosed or in just with mental health problems. And then we also have Dr. Ramesh, who is a second physician down at UM Capital Region Health, and he serves both the Laurel Hospital and the hospital facility at Prince George's. And then our last physician speaker, little bit different approach. He is a physician at the University of Maryland in community and family health. He is the son of two heroin addicted parents, and he has risen to become a physician. He will talk about his journey. He's written a book called The Hard Way, which describes what he's done since he was just a young child trying to help take care of the family, how often they moved, and the struggles that they had, and the struggles that followed him for quite a long time.
And his name is?
His name is Dr. Jason Ramirez.
That's Donna Jacobs, Senior Vice President with the University of Maryland Medical System. Next Wednesday, the University of Maryland's Baltimore campus will host a community event about opioid addiction and recovery. So, Donna, what is the University of Maryland Medical System hoping the community takes from this session? How do you expect it to unfold?
For each of the segments, and there are five, we've built in lots of time for question and answer. So there'll be a presentation from each presenter and then an equal amount of time for question and answers from each one. So we're hoping that the community will ask what it is that they're curious about. We also, we're going to live stream this. So the main event is downtown in Baltimore, but there are also four other sites that where people can go to tune in on the shore, Eastern Shore at Chesapeake College, down in Charles County at the hospital there, at St. Joseph's Medical Center, and in Prince George's County at Bowie State, together with UM Capital Region Health. Each of those locations will also have local providers, aside from the hospital, that provide services in the community. And they'll be there throughout the morning to talk about the resources they have available, to answer questions, and to provide information for future services that people may seek.
What's the significance of the title, Not All Wounds Are Visible?
People think about healthcare in determinable ways that you can see. Someone is physically ill. Someone walks with a limp. Someone's lost a tremendous amount of weight. And there are so many health situations that we've become accustomed to. What we're not accustomed to talking about is mental health or substance abuse. It's hidden. In many communities, people don't want to admit that they may have an issue. They don't want to come forward. They don't want anyone to know. And the same pertains to substance abuse. So as we thought about this, we wanted a title that would be attractive to the community. And so we want to be able to unearth the things that people don't talk about. We walk around our communities with things that we suffer from that we don't want people to know.
I appreciate you telling us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Donna Jacobs is a senior vice president with the University of Maryland Medical System. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we will link to information about the free community event, Not All Wounds Are Visible, which will take place at the University of Maryland's Baltimore campus, 621 West Lombard Street, from 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. next Wednesday. It will be live streamed to university-affiliated hospitals. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.